Thank you very much, Arnie. It's a pleasure to be on the program today and to return again to speaking at the sessions of the Vietnam Caucus. I really support the work that you're doing. I'm going to talk today about the impact of war on non-combatant civilians. And let me just say at the start that I and my close colleague, Dr. Victor Seidel, received a small amount of royalties from books that we have edited on war, terrorism, and social injustice and the relationship with public health. There are seven areas I want to highlight in my presentation today on the adverse health consequences of war on non-combatant civilians as listed here on the slide. I'll go through them as we go through. I don't need necessarily to read the list, but there are numerous, thank you, impacts, not only the direct impacts, but a number of the indirect impacts that may not be readily apparent at the start. Direct impacts on health. During the 20th century, there are almost 200 million people died as a result of war and related catastrophic events, and that if you look back to the time of World War I and earlier, the percentage of deaths to non-combatant civilians has steadily increased. It's really hard getting accurate data on this, there is certainly some data on some recent wars that the percentage of all deaths during those wars have been 80 to 90% or even greater. Civilian deaths, for example, in the Vietnam War estimated to be at least 4 million overall. Related figures is that in South Vietnam alone, a million widows, perhaps more, and 800,000 orphans. In the Iraq War, the estimates vary on the number of non-combatant civilian deaths from the range of 100 to 150,000, excuse me, to more than 650,000, and the creation of over a 30-year period from 1980 to 2010 of a million or more widows as a result of the Iraq War, or wars in Iraq. U.S. military deaths and military personnel wounded are shown on this slide. For the Vietnam War, over 58,000 deaths and more than 300,000 wounded. In the Iraq War, over 4,000 deaths and more than 30,000 wounded. This does not begin to count the number of people with a number of other problems, such as post-traumatic stress disorder and other mental health problems. The mental health consequences have included not only PTSD, but depression, anxiety, alcohol and substance abuse, violence inflicted on the family members, and suicide, and mental health consequences due to stress and related issues among family members, including children. There have been, of course, adverse, if you look at wars in general, there are a number of adverse effects on medical care and public health services, as shown on the slide. Physicians, nurses, and other health workers are injured or killed, or they flee. For example, a systematic review of physician specialists in Baghdad during the middle part of the last decade, from roughly 2003 to 2006 or so, showed that roughly 22% of the physician specialists at several hospitals in Baghdad had fled Baghdad. Some fled the country, some fled to more areas outside of Baghdad. Damage to clinics and hospitals. Breakdown of the supply of medications and vaccines, certainly reduction in public health services. Remember from the start of the war in Iraq in 2003, U.S. military helped to guard the Ministry of Oil, but did not guard clinics or hospitals. Initially, only two of roughly 35 hospitals had functioning emergency departments during what was described as shock and awe during the beginning of the war with intensive bombing. Very important and often overlooked, but perhaps the greatest impact is damage to the health supporting infrastructure and the environment that's shown here. Not only immediate effects on food safety and supply, water safety and supply, but long-term effects. For example, during the Persian Gulf War, some water treatment facilities in Iraq were targeted. They were either completely destroyed or severely damaged. And because of the embargo that took place up until 1998, from roughly 1990 to 1998, many parts were not available. And even to this day, some of those water treatment facilities are not functioning as well as they should be. Damage to health and supporting infrastructure also affects sewage treatment, electrical power, transportation, communications, and course, there's been substantial environmental damage that really has not been systematically assessed. There are some papers, some statements from the U.S. military acknowledging severe environmental contamination around some U.S. military bases in Iraq, but no one really has done a systematic evaluation of the damage to the environment. These are a couple of slides, both from Vietnam, showing damage to the environment. Both of them, both these slides, this one and the next one, show damage to mangrove swamps. This as a result of use of extensive use of the defoliant Agent Orange, contaminated with dioxin. And this is an aerial view of craters, some of which still exist in Vietnam, from U.S. bombing runs. These showing again mangrove swamps that are partially destroyed, and these huge craters become breeding grounds. Because they hold stagnant water, they become breeding grounds for mosquitoes and other vectors that spread disease, such as malaria. Another major impact is refugees and internally displaced persons. The most current figures, and these may indeed be underestimates, approximately 15 million refugees in the world, many of whom have been refugees for decades. 28 million internally displaced persons who may be many of whom are in worse shape and face greater health and security risks. They are, in effect, refugees within their own countries, often with less access to food and water and health services than the refugees who have been successful in getting to another country where food and water and overall security are stronger. And then showing some of the major refugee displacements shown on the slide. During the Vietnam War, during the Afghanistan War, where between 2001 and 2009, 75% of Afghans at one time or another were forced to flee their homes, and the huge number of millions of refugees created in the Iraq War, often to countries such as Syria, which are, aside from the recent revolution going on in Syria, many countries that receive refugees are challenged to provide basic human services to their own populations, much less refugees. Factors that make refugees and internally displaced persons particularly vulnerable are inadequate security, even around refugee camps, reduced access to safe food and water, as I mentioned, poor sanitation, even within camps, reduced access to medical care and public health services, and inadequate shelter and clothing. The following are a series of pictures I took in a Cambodian refugee camp in 1980, so a long time ago. This is a refugee camp in Thailand for Cambodian refugees. Actually, they were not formally granted refugee status because to do so would make them permanent, would give them permanent residence in Thailand. This refugee camp is bad. So, as some of these pictures may look, was actually among the better refugee camps over time. About 120,000 Cambodians lived in this camp. They actually helped to construct these huts made of straw and burlap with materials supplied by the UN and other agencies. Malnutrition was a serious problem. By the way, those of us who worked there and who worked in other refugee camps have often been struck by the dignity of the people and their resilience to go on in the face of all that they've lived through. Providing basic food and nutrition was very important in the camp, and also about 70 trucks shown here a day came in to supply water. As you know, refugee camps are often places that are very desolate, often without any available safe water or firewood or other basic necessities. This is one of about 10 wards of the field hospital at the camp. Is a pediatric ward where mothers often stayed with their children to help provide needed nursing services, basically, although there were a number of many nurses and physicians and even nursing and medical students working in the camp. Malnutrition was a major problem, particularly in the early days of the camp, and infectious diseases were a problem throughout the period of time that we were working there. It was interesting that this camp had a number of other medical services and public health services, including a rehabilitation ward. You may notice some markings on this man's chest, I'm not sure if they're easy to see, but he had undergone a treatment called coining, where a hot coin is rubbed against the surface of the skin, which apparently has at least some effect. It may be a placebo effect. It may have some physiologic basis to address some of the pain he was feeling. This man came to the eye clinic, where people were able to get eyeglasses for the first time in 4 years. Many people threw away their eyeglasses, understandably, during the Pol Pot regime, to have an education, to have any hint of a tie with Western countries, or even to wear glasses was a sign that you were educated, or perhaps even worse, had ties with the West. So people got rid of their eyeglasses. Many pretended they were peasant farmers in order to survive, and this man said when he put on the glasses he had forgotten how beautiful the world was. And this is part of a public health campaign. There were about 50 Cambodian public health workers in the public health department in the camp. Many of them were physicians or nurses or public health workers in Cambodia before the Pol Pot regime. When there was a polio outbreak of about 10 cases, this man and others were engaged in giving oral polio vaccine, which ended that epidemic. Another problem, of course, in the impact on non-combatant civilians is the many human rights violations. Civilians are not only caught in the crossfire, but increasingly they are consciously targeted as a tactic or strategy of war. Sexual assaults on women, rape of women, and other sexual assaults. Sometimes, in fact, all too often, women are forced to become sexual slaves to the military. Abduction of children, often into the military forces. Ethnic cleansing, torture of prisoners, and other violations of the Geneva Conventions, which unfortunately our own country has been engaged in, and the so-called war on terror, and violations of medical neutrality. A Republican president 60 years ago, said that every gun that's made, every warship launched, every rocket signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. Dwight Eisenhower said this in his farewell address in 1961. Military expenditures, and this is right out of the yearbook of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, current data showing military expenditures by the United States of almost $700 billion. I put the zeros in here to enable us to begin grasping the magnitude when we say $700 billion. It's a number that's incomprehensible. It begins to get incomprehensible when you look to see what the cost is in terms of reduced budgets for public health and other basic health and human services. The budget for military expenditures by the United States, these are the most recent available data, dwarfs that of all of Europe put together, dwarfs that of China, more than threefold that of China, dwarfs that of all of the Middle East, where a country we've served, where for many years, of course, we've sold weapons to many countries, and more than sevenfold the size of the military budget of Russia. Now, I've showed this slide for a number of years, showing that per capita, so per person government expenditures on military and health, these are data from 1990, where several countries, all the examples here from Africa, spend far more on military per person than on health. Now, there's some good news in this presentation. Here are data that I just calculated in the last week. So these are the data 20 years ago. These are data for military 2010 and for health expenditures 2008 from the World Bank and other sources. Ethiopia, which was 16 to 1 before, is now 4 to 37. So they're spending much more on health than on military. Chad, which was 10 to 1 before, is now 20 to 86. That is, for every person in Chad, the government now spends $86 on health and only, but it's still a substantial amount, $20 on military. And Angola, which was 114 to 8 before, is now 196 to 183. Now, these are somewhat inexact figures, but it's showing that perhaps there is finally a realization that that security has a lot more to do with providing basic human services for one's population, for a country's population, than military expenditures. Bad news that's getting worse each year, the ranking of the U.S. among all countries of the world in various parameters, the military parameters shown here, such as arms exports, military expenditures, military technology, we still rank number one. the life expectancy. This comes right out of the CIA World Factbook estimates for this year, 2011. Life expectancy, we rank 50th in the world, and infant mortality rate, we rank 47th in the world. Cuba, by the way, passed us several years ago. It was noted by the New York Times at that time. The first $204 billion spent on the Iraq War, so during the first few years of that war, and the amount spent on that war now is closer to over $800 billion, not counting the interest on the debt, which may drive that amount up to over $3 trillion ultimately. That first $200 billion or so could have been spent to do all of the following for 3 years. 50% decrease in world hunger, a comprehensive HIV global AIDS program, HIV and AIDS program, a complete immunization of all children in less developed countries or low-income countries, and meeting the unmet needs worldwide for clean water and sewage treatment. So when we start comparing the amount of money that's spent, often with a blank check on military expenditures versus what it could be used for to really improve health and well-being and indeed security around the world, it's mind-boggling. Finally, in terms of the impact on non-combatant civilians, war promotes further violence. We do so as a nation in part by the international transfer of major conventional weapons, basically the arms trade, which has increased 22% over the last decade. We again far outrank a number of other countries in our share of global arms exports. We account for 30% versus 23% for Russia, 11% for Germany, and so forth. We are the largest supplier of arms in the world. And I want to conclude with some thoughts about what we as public health workers can do in addressing some of these issues. The only way indeed to prevent the impact of war on non-combatant civilians is indeed to end war itself. Despite our best attempts with smart bombs and a whole bunch of I think serious attempts to try to limit the impact of war on civilian populations, we are still of course falling far short. Now, many of us, how many have seen this triangle before, host, environment, and agents, as a way of addressing problems like malaria? I mean, you can try to immunize the host, you can try to kill the parasites, you can try to alter the environment, such as removing places where mosquitoes may breed, as I showed the pits before in Vietnam. This triangle, by the way, can be applied to a number of other situations, including war. And by the way, it's not only the points on the triangle, but it's the lines on the triangle, and it's the middle of the triangle we need to think about. So how does a host interact with environment? How do agents interact with environment, and so forth? But applying this model to the prevention of war, there are strategies that could be aimed at the host, that is, aimed at people. Strategies aimed at agents, such as weapons, the military forces, and the military-industrial complex, and strategies aimed at environment, strategies to improve the conditions in which people live, which are often the underlying causes of war and armed conflict. So replacing host agents and environment with people, weapons and military, and the conditions in which people live, we can take this a step further. Strategies aimed at people, and these are only meant to be illustrative, to get us to begin thinking in a public health framework of how to prevent war, how to create a world without war and a culture of peace, but promoting understanding among peoples. These are things that are common sense, but I think it helps to think about it in this framework. Promote economic, social interdependency among nations. It is said, I think somewhat apocryphally, but I think it is true that no two nations that both had McDonald's have ever gone to war against one another. Now, I haven't fully investigated that, but the broader notion that to the extent that there's economic and social interdependency among nations, it's less likely that they would go to war with one another. Despite the fact that we have disagreements with China in many respects, I think it's unthinkable that we would have a war with China given the close economic and indeed social interdependency among the United States and China. Other strategies promoting nonviolent resolutions of disputes and conflicts at all levels, starting with disputes in communities and within families, developing the popular and political will to prevent war and promote peace, and then strategies aimed at weapons in the military, such as those shown on this slide, such as controlling the arms trade, eliminating weapons of mass destruction, reducing military expenditures, and intervening in disputes before they become war. And finally, strategies to improve the conditions in which people live, protecting human rights and civil liberties, reducing poverty and economic disparities, improving education and employment opportunities, and ensuring personal security and legal protections. Again, to help to improve the conditions in which people live, and indeed, one of the goals of public health is assuring the conditions in which people can be healthy. So once again, I think we need to be thinking in terms of a host agents environment framework if we want to indeed create a world without war. I think we in public health have a lot to contribute to this discussion of bringing about a more peaceful, indeed a peaceful world without war. Thinking in these terms, and again, the only way to prevent the impact of war on non-combatant civilians, as much as we might try other means, is indeed to prevent and end war itself. Thank you very much.